We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Robert H. Frank, professor from Cornell University, author of Success and Luck, Good Fortune, and the Myth of Meritocracy. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thanks to you, Sam, for having me on. I'm really glad to be with you.
Okay, let's just, it is our pleasure. All right, so let's start in with this book basically attempts to get at why the rich hate paying taxes, or I should say, and maybe that's I'm short-circuiting it a little bit, but it explains or attempts to, I guess, explain the myth of the meritocracy and the problems that arise both from sort of a personal standpoint and a public policy standpoint when people buy into that myth too much. Tell us, let's start with what that myth is.
Yeah, I think, I'll start with the sentence that I had to pay $500 to use in the front pages of the book. It's E.B. White's comment from the 1930s that luck is not a subject you can discuss in the presence of self-made men. The image he conjures up is of the person who started a business and succeeded and then just is not even open to the idea that he might have been lucky at some point along the way or that circumstances might have been favorable without which he wouldn't have done as well as he's done. So that kind of posture is fairly common. And one effect of it, and this I do talk about evidence for this claim in the book quite a bit, one effect of that is that it makes people feel a strong sense of entitlement to all the income that's come their way in the marketplace. So I did it. I succeeded because of my own talent and hard work. Therefore, all the dollars that came my way are mine to keep. And that's the attitude that I think has been getting the country into a little bit of a bind over the last decades as we've consistently refused to make renewal investments in the kind of infrastructure and public support that enabled the success stories of the last generation to break out themselves.
Now, do you think that the relationship between that notion of I did this all on my my own, and therefore I deserve all this money, let's say, does it work that way, or does it go backwards? Is it a rationalization on some level?
You know, it could be. It could be. People do think that the more money they have, the happier they'll be. There's a certain sense in which that's a cognitive illusion. We could talk about that presently. But I think it's an honest mistake for the most part. You know, let's suppose you're a big success. How did you get to be one? Well, the world's pretty competitive now. It used to be that if your family knew somebody or if you had cronies, that was enough to get you into a really high-paying position. We still see some of that, but the world has gotten to be a lot more like the NBA in the last decades. If you're not producing, there's not room for you in more and more markets now. And so the people who succeed these days, I think, for the most part, really are very capable. They work very hard. Often they're not the most capable and hardworking of the people who were competing for the plum jobs they got. They were just a little luckier. They were almost as hardworking and talented, but not quite. And so if you try to construct your own life narrative, I mean, here I am, I'm a big success. Why am I a success? Well, you think back and you retrieve what you can from memory. You got up every day, you worked hard, you were talented, you know you were solving problems that a lot of others couldn't solve. And so the narrative that springs to your mind is quite naturally, I did it on my own. You know, I worked hard and I'm talented. So I'm willing to grant them a little leeway there. It's just that if you have that attitude, it blinds you to the need to pay forward for the next group that comes along. You didn't succeed completely on your own. You know, if you didn't have roads to ship your goods to market, you wouldn't have been able to build that successful business. You know, the people you hired, well, we in the community paid to educate them. So there is an implicit requirement that you do pay forward for the next group that comes along. I mean, people who are born in many countries around the world, doesn't matter how hard they work or how talented they are, there's just no avenue along which they might succeed.
Right. And this was, in many respects, the big theme in the 2012 election. Elizabeth Warren said, you know, was I mean, Barack Obama said it as well. And Elizabeth Warren hit it. This you didn't build that. And, you know, your book reminded me there were two things that really struck me. And you have examples in your book about, you know, sort of just. I guess, I don't know, dumb luck is the right way of saying it in terms of just sort of your own experience, the fact that we're talking on the phone, that you're still around. And maybe it might be good to tell that story. But while we're here, it played a big part in the 2012 election. And there's one thing that sticks out to me, and I want to play this tape of Mitt Romney, because not only was the right very offended at that notion of you didn't build that, and I want to talk about that, but this Mitt Romney even takes it even further here. This is Mitt Romney in that famous 47% tape, but here he's talking about the misfortune he had in that his dad was not actually born of Mexican parents. Because he's convinced that if he was Latino, he would have already been president. And this is just go. Let's listen to this audio.
Okay.
My dad, you probably know, was the governor of Michigan and was the head of a car company. But he was born in Mexico. And had he been born of Mexican parents, I'd have a better shot of winning this. But he was
And he goes on to say, people laugh, and he says, you know, that's a joke, but it's actually true. And so here he is, both ticking off the idea that his father was a governor of Michigan and the head of what was the third largest car company in the United States. And he's bemoaning the fact that he wasn't Latino because otherwise he'd be president. So this is and part of this is, I want to tee up here, is that this isn't just about luck. For him, there is something structural too that it reveals. Isn't
sure,
it?
Sure. Well, I mean, luck comes in many forms. A friend of mine got struck by lightning. He survived miraculously. That was bad luck. That's clearly just a random event, as I see it. But structural things clearly matter. I had a cook when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal. He remains the most resourceful person I think I've ever met lifelong. He never earned much, even though he could do so many things to such a high standard. There just weren't opportunities for him to make use of his talent in that environment. If he'd been born here, or at least here at about the time I was born, there would have been lots of paths for him to make it near the top. It's a sad thing when we read that the smart kids who grow up in poor families, the ones who have top quartile math scores, they're less likely to graduate from college now than the bottom quartile kids in math who happen to be born in rich families. Sure, there are huge structural advantages. That's part of your luck. You know, where are you born? What sort of circumstances do you confront when you come into the world?
And doesn't that, I mean, I'm sort of circling back to that. I wonder how much of that how much of that drives that sense that I deserve this. In other words, like if I am aware that it's not just even luck, but it's actually like a design of society on some level. And that gets, I think, to the meritocracy. If it's a design of society that has made it easier for me to get here. Yes, I worked hard. Yes, I'm talented. But I'm here because, you know, I was because of certain designs in society. If I'm conscious of that, it makes things very uncomfortable for me or for some people, perhaps.
Well, it does make some people uncomfortable, but one of the messages I try to push in the book is that if you were really to reflect on that and try to appreciate the deeper message of it, it would not make you feel uncomfortable at all. It would make you feel grateful for the advantages that you've enjoyed. And the research is just crystal clear on the effect of that. When we induce feelings of gratitude in people in the lab, they become happier, their health improves over the subsequent weeks, they become more generous, more willing to incur costs to benefit others. It's a almost a magical elixir. You know, people think that they would be happier if they paid out less to benefit others, but that's just not the way the evidence comes down on that question.
Tell people a little bit about those experiments in the lab, as it were, in terms of building gratitude.
One of my research assistants cooked up a very clever design. What she did was she gave a large sample of people in an online experiment this instruction: tell me about a good thing that happened to you recently. And then one group of them, she said, list three things you did or traits you had that contributed to that thing happening. That's the first group. The second group, she said, list three external things, things outside your control that contributed to the good thing happening. And then a control group, the third group, she just said, tell me about a good thing that happened. And then everybody got a big bonus, not a big bonus, a bonus at the end of the experiment. And they were told they could donate some or all of it to a charity. There were three. They could pick one and donate the bonus to any of them. And the ones who had been asked to list external causes for the good thing happening, many of them mentioned luck explicitly. Others mentioned someone who had helped them or some circumstantial aspect of their surroundings. Those people gave 25% more to charity than the people who had listed things they had done that had caused the good thing to happen. The control group fell squarely in the middle, as she expected. There have been many other experiments along those lines. You can induce gratitude in people quite easily, as it turns out, if you have the clever manipulations that psychologists use to do it. So somebody will be working on a hard task on a computer. The computer crashes, or at least appears to crash. A confederate of the experimenter says, oh, that happened to me last week, and I was able to recover the hour of lost data that seemed to have gone up in smoke. And she hits a few keystrokes, the computer miraculously comes back to life. And we know, both from asking people and from other evidence, that they really do experience gratitude in the wake of that intervention. And then they're given a chance to help a stranger at their own expense, either spend some time helping the stranger complete a task or donate some money to the stranger, various forms of help to others. And the ones in whom gratitude have been induced are much, much more likely to spend time and their own resources helping others. And they're not unhappy about it. There have been other studies that have shown, here's $20, they'll say to a subject. One group's told to go buy something for yourself. And then another group is told, buy something for someone else with the $20. And that second group reports very substantially higher feelings of well-being after the purchase. So, yeah, I think, and it's my own profession that's in large measure responsible here. We teach people that humans are selfish in the narrow sense of the term, and that the more they have, the happier they'll be. But you know, human psychology turns out to be a lot more complicated than that.
So how do we take that dynamic and have it enhance our public policy? Or let's start with, I think people in this audience have a sense of what the goal would be in terms of public policy, which would be to create, and I don't know, you tell me, I mean, a more generous welfare state, reinvest more in our, human and physical infrastructure. Give us a sense first what the goal would be in terms of public policy, and then how would we induce that gratitude? I assume we can't break into, you know, Donald Trump's office and break his computer for an hour or something.
Yeah, I like the list you started with, Sam. A friend of mine who'd lived in Australia for a couple of years offered a similar list. He said, people in Australia don't seem worried the way my friends here are. He said, they're not worried that they're going to be able to send their kids to college. That's part of the package in Australia. They're not worried that if they get sick, they'll go bankrupt. That's not a risk they're exposed to there either. And then finally, if they retire, they're not worried they'll have to eat dog food if they've been caught with some unexpected bills. So those sorts of things we could just take off the table. The three main sources of anxiety that families have, we could easily afford to remove that from the worry screen. And evidence is clear that people are happier when they don't have that hang over their head, that kind of risk. So we could do that, repair the infrastructure. And people balk at it and say, well, yeah, I guess we ought to do that, but it would be too expensive. I'd have to give up too much of what I need. But here's the interesting fact about economics that's grossly underappreciated still, in my view. It's that once you're prosperous, your ability to get what you want depends almost entirely on your relative purchasing power, not your absolute purchasing power. So a friend of mine was fretting about all the new taxes that President Obama had in store for us. This was a couple of years ago. He was a Fox News watcher, and he was all lathered up about this. And he was angry that I didn't even know about most of these new taxes. He thought I'd been irresponsible not to follow the news. I told him, no, look, I don't know about those taxes because they don't matter for people like you and me. He said, what do you mean? I said, look, you've got everything you need. He's the author of a successful textbook. He'll never spend as much as he earns in Ithaca. Maybe in New York, he'd figure out how to spend it all. But I have a textbook, too. I'm not without anything I need. And so what is it? You're worried that they're going to change the tax code that will make it harder for us to get what we want? Yeah, that was what he was worried about. So people like us, what we want is something special, you know, home with a view of the lake, a nice slip at the marina, a choice painting, whatever it might be. It's things that there aren't enough of. How do you get those things? You bid against other people like you, and the high bidders get them. The people who aren't willing to bid, who don't care as much or don't have enough money, don't get them. And when you pay higher taxes and I pay higher taxes, and others like us also pay higher taxes, the question of who gets those things, the house with the view goes to the same person as before, the marina slip does too, those allocations are completely unaffected if our tax payments go up by a little bit. So we could do this. You know, we could part with some of the extra income that we have. The evidence is very clear that we'd be just as happy as before. And at the same time, we, the successful ones in society, would benefit from having a more fully revitalized public sphere. So I asked my friend, who's happier, a Ferrari driver on the kind of roads we have, they're riddled with foot-deep potholes, or a Porsche driver on well-maintained roads? Porsche costs about half what the Ferrari does. The Porsche driver on well-maintained roads would clearly be a happier driver, and it would cost less. The total amount of money you'd spend on Porsches and road maintenance would be less in a regime that attended to road maintenance than the total spent on Ferraris and lack of road maintenance in the current regime. So really, it's not a question of having to give up anything important. There would really be no sacrifice. And I think that's what makes me hopeful. You know, if we could talk about this without kindling the knee-jerk anger response, I think the successful people in society would be much more receptive to reforms along these lines than if they thought it was going to make them miserable to have to part with some of the payments for these goods.
And that's what you talk about, the availability heuristic, right? And this, that notion that you will all be able to get, the house with the view or the, but isn't it also possible? And you tell me, because you've probably looked at this data more than I have, that while the ride for that Porsche might be nicer on a smooth road, the idea of owning a Ferrari, even if it just sits in my driveway, may also hold some value. In other words, I don't.
Oh, it does. It definitely does.
And that it's not just a question of a fear that I won't be able to purchase what I want, just an attitude of like, this is mine. It's mine, and it's I don't want it to go to someone else who doesn't deserve it as much as I do. And I also, I'm trying to hit a number, and that number is higher than some other person's number. And it's not really about the use because, the old saying, I think we had Nick Hanauer on here, and he said, you know, a rich guy buys one loaf of bread at a time. Well, that may be the case, but I think there are a lot of rich people who are just like, look at how many loaves of bread I can buy today.
Okay, I think though, Sam, you just answered your own question because you said the rich guy's trying to hit a number. What's that number? It's the number that's bigger than the other rich guy's number. And if taxes that the rich people pay all go up by 5% or 10% or 4%, the guy with the biggest number has the biggest number after tax too. If it really is relative purchasing power. So if you're in a Nordic country where taxes are higher and the rich there can afford only the Porsche, that Porsche seems just as special to them as a Ferrari would seem in a low tax country where Ferraris are actually quite common. So really, this is something that's hard for people to appreciate. You know, I don't feel critical of people for not thinking in these terms. It's not even natural to think in those terms. But you know, you want your daughter's wedding to seem special. Well, special is a purely relative concept. And if everyone else is spending a lot on weddings, now the last year I have numbers for, $31,000 was the average wedding in the U.S. in New York City, in Manhattan, at $76,000.
Oh my God! I have a dog.
In 1980, it was $10,000. Nobody thinks that people getting married today are happier because they're spending three times as much. Nobody thinks that. It's just that the standards that define special have escalated, and so that's a wedding. A proper wedding now costs three times as much as before, and if you don't do a proper wedding, you know, it doesn't feel right. So
are those adjusted dollars? I'm just trying to work this out so that I can.
Inflation adjusted dollars.
Wow.
Yeah, it's gone up by a factor of three in real terms. And so, you know, no wonder people feel like they're under a lot of financial stress. They've to buy the median house. If you don't buy the median priced house, your kid goes to bad schools. So, of course, parents are going to do what they need to. But the median house now costs way more than it did in real terms.
How is income inequality factored into this? Because your average person, let's say, now they have the ability to look at and I think you write about that guy who had Rod Stewart at his kid's bar mitzvah or something, and how does my kid, when she turns 13, she sees this story about somebody having, Justin Bieber at their bar mitzvah. How do I make my kid, never mind just the fact that it's, isn't that also that dynamic happening here too, that when you have that type of wealth inequality, that it also creates that pressure? So that notion of availability, it skews
absolutely
that as well?
Absolutely, yeah. It figures in interestingly, in two different ways. There's more luck in the labor market because the really big prizes in the labor market now are winner-take-all tournaments, essentially. You've got thousands of contestants chasing after a handful of jobs at the top, and the ones who get those jobs, I mean, all the real contestants are very talented and hardworking. The ones who end up winning those contests are rarely the most talented and hardworking. They're almost as talented as the most talented and hardworking contestant, but they're so close to that contestant that the most talented contestant will just have average luck. There are some of the contestants who are almost as talented who have had way above average luck. So they'll typically be the winners. So that's one way that inequality is shaped by luck more than it used to be in the past. But as for the demonstration effects, I don't think your daughter is going to look at somebody hiring Rod Stewart or Justin Bieber and ask you, Dad, how come we can't do that? The people of more normal means, they kind of like to see the fancy parties and mansions and yachts. You know, they want to see pictures of them and hear about them. But the effect is nonetheless real because there are people just below the top. They go to the $10 million birthday party, and now that shifts the standard that applies to the parties they host. They've got to spend $9.5 million. And one level at a time, it just cascades down. And if you can't see that cascade happening, it's very difficult to explain why is the median priced house 50% more expensive than it used to be. You know, the people in the middle don't have more income. You know, they're spending more because people like them are spending more. Why are the others spending more? Because ultimately, because people at the top have been capturing all the gains in income, and we've seen this cascade all the way down the income ladder.
Well, I will say you don't know my daughter in terms of the Bieber thing. But aside from that, so what you're describing is also sometimes described as fractal inequality. I remember hearing about at Davos how pained the 100 millionaires are when they see the billionaires get to go up to the top VIP floor. Literally, I don't know what the physicality is there, but I've heard that is. That is a very tough pill to swallow when you see the billionaires going into the, I don't know, the captain's room or whatever it is. That you're just stuck there with your hundred millions and you're in the lieutenant's quarters or whatever it is.
Here's where our economic narrative runs completely onto the reefs. You know, the standard economic models make no allowance for the phenomenon you just described. You know, if you look at those models, they say your car is okay, your house is okay, all the things you have are okay if they're of a certain absolute quality level. There's no mention of frames of reference or how context shapes people's evaluations. But, you know, if you're going for a job and everybody else is wearing a $2,000 suit, your $300 suit is going to put you in poor stead with the interviewers. If everyone else is wearing a $100 suit, you're fine in the $300 suit. My house, when I was in the Peace Corps, it had two rooms, no plumbing, no electricity. It leaked if it rained hard. At no point did that house seem in any way satisfactory, but your daughter wouldn't want her friends to know where you lived if you lived in a house like that here in the U.S. My kids certainly wouldn't have wanted their friends to know we lived in a house like that. And the people from Nepal, if they saw my house here, they'd think, whoa, he's taking complete leave of his senses. Why would anybody need such a grand house as that? But you wouldn't think that. This is part of the package, and because we don't recognize it, we've got all these economic policies that steer us in the wrong direction.
And how much of this is sort of is baked into our culture? In other words, you know, you talk about a study with cookies, tell us about that study, because that to me seems like this isn't just the dynamic here is not just about sort of relativity and envy, but that there may be something intrinsic in our culture, maybe not just ours, maybe broadly speaking, Western culture, that's driving this. But tell us about the cookie study.
This is a study by Dr. Keltner at Berkeley, a psychologist, and his co-authors. They had a group of three students sit down in a room and deliberate over some complicated ethical question, what to do about a student who had cheated on an exam, for example. And arbitrarily, they appointed one person as chairman of the group. Then half an hour later, they sent someone in with a tray with four cookies on it and just left it there. And in each case, they observed what happened and who ate the cookies. Well, the arbitrarily appointed leader in every single case ate the fourth cookie. So each of them ate one, but the leader, whom they all knew had been arbitrarily chosen, just chosen at random, obviously felt entitled to eat that fourth cookie. So yes, they're if you achieve something, even if it's clearly not of your own doing, you feel entitled to keep whatever comes along that you might lay claim to. And
did the other members of that committee also feel like, well, you know, he's chairman, so his blood sugar level might...
It didn't provoke howls of protest from the others. Yeah, I think there's a sense that, oh, well, you know, somebody's got to eat the cookie. Why not the leader?
I mean, so what is behind that? I mean, why is it that we, I mean, that seems to me to be a cultural phenomenon. And the other dynamics that we're talking about are sort of laid on top of it and have been in some way unleashed, right? I mean, I'm convinced that cookie experiment is basically what we just witnessed in the Republican primary, right? I mean, this guy's a billionaire.
Yeah.
It's like, these are my cookies.
There's a lot of human nature on display in the last few months that we've seen on the.
I would argue primate nature on display.
Well, you want to call it cultural, and it is surely partly cultural. But I was curious about this. I did an experiment with my two older boys. Somebody told me a human subjects committee wouldn't approve this experiment today. But what I did was, I gave them each a full glass of orange juice on day one. It's a 3-day experiment. So David is 7 years old. Jason is 5 years old. So a full glass of orange juice on day one. They drink it without comment. I'm taking notes what happens each day. Day two, I give them half a glass of orange juice. What do? They drink it without comment yet again. They don't say, hey, how come we got only half a glass of orange juice today? That's not right. They just drank it, didn't say anything. Orange juice, I guess, no big deal. Day three, I give David, the 7-year-old, a full glass, and Jason, the 5-year-old, 7/8 of a glass. It was close. You know, you had to look carefully, and Jason did look carefully. His eyes, I could see them darting back and forth between the two glasses, sizing up what the situation was. And then he knew, I think, that it wouldn't play out well for him, but he just couldn't contain himself finally. And he said, shouted, "That's not fair. He always gets more than me." And then that was, of course, that was my cue to give my speech. Oh, don't worry about what other people have. If you want more orange juice, I'll get you some. Just, you know, if you're worried about somebody having more or better than you, you're going to be miserable your whole life. But, you know, you do have to worry about how you're doing. If you don't ask yourself, how am I doing, once in a while, you're going to fare pretty poorly in this competitive world that we inhabit. So you got to care about how you're doing. And the only way to think about how am I doing is in relative terms. You know, if there's no absolute standard for how you're doing, you have to do well enough to compete effectively.
Did that experiment work? Are your kids older now? Did they?
They're quite a lot older now. But you know, I would not want them to be purged of the impulse to ask how am I doing and to, you know, take reasonable cues from the environment to try to answer that question. But yeah, somebody who complains he always gets more than me isn't going to be invited to many dinner parties. you got to learn to calm down a little bit about that impulse.
So how do we do this on how do we do this on a grander scale? I mean, what is the way? And then I want to talk just briefly about the progressive consumption tax. If we were able to convince, and I want to make it clear too, we're taking a little bit of a shortcut here, but there's been a lot of, and we've talked about it on this show, and we've interviewed Martin Gillins on this topic. There's a lot of data to support the idea that policies that are favored by the wealthy in this country are far more likely, almost always likely, to be expressed legislatively than those of the rest of us. So one tact is, of course, to cut down the resistance of wealthy people to being taxed more. And I also got to just put in a qualification here. I'll put a pin in the idea that we can actually just print money because of concepts like modern monetary theory. But in terms of taxation, if we want to even just think about it in terms
right.
of maintaining some wealth, diminish wealth inequality, how do we convince these people that, like, hey, you know, you're still going to be able to get that house. It's going to be just cheaper, just relatively speaking, if everybody
right.
takes a tax, a tax bite.
You know, I there was an excerpt from my book that was published in Vox last week, and Kevin Drum over at Mother Jones wrote a nice piece riffing on some of the points in it. And he listed numerous ways in which he himself had been extremely lucky in his own life. And then he quarreled a little bit with what he took to be my claim that if you just tell rich people that they've been lucky, they'll be willing to pay more in taxes. He didn't think that was actually a plausible prediction. And I wrote back to him and I told him, yeah, I don't really claim quite that. And no, I don't think if you just tell people that they've been lucky, that will make them willing to pay more taxes. It's really very much like the Elizabeth Warren speech you cited at the top of our conversation. You note that she said, you didn't build that. Well, she said, I listened to her speech very carefully. Most of what she said, no reasonable person could possibly disagree with. She said, you built a successful business, good. You shipped your goods to market on roads the rest of us paid for, and so on. The social contract calls on you to pay forward for the next group that comes along. All perfectly reasonable. But what they were hearing was that you think you built your business. Well, we built your business. You didn't build that. We built that. I don't think that's rhetorically a successful way to frame the issue. And so I wrote back to Kevin that my experience has been if you just tell a successful person that he's been lucky, that kindles the same kind of anger and resentment that you saw in response to the Elizabeth Warren speech. There were millions of angry comments on the internet about that speech. What's amazing, therefore, is that if you take a slightly different approach to the conversation, if you say to your successful friend, can you think of any examples of lucky breaks you've enjoyed along the way? That completely disables this angry defensive reaction. You can see the wheels start turning behind their eyes. They're thinking hard. And when they think of an example of a break that they had on their path to success, the first thing they want to do is tell you about it in great detail. And then they'll think of another one. And they get happier and happier the more examples they can think of. And it's that conversation that opens the door to saying, yeah, well, I had those breaks. Yeah, we should be really doing more to see that others have a chance to move forward.
But
so that's step one. If you could just launch that conversation, you'd have such a much more fertile environment for talking about these issues.
But how do we launch that conversation as a matter of public policy? I mean, it's one thing for folks here to go, listening to the program and go out and find the most successful person you know who is not interested in paying taxes and you know, sit down maybe and have a drink with them, and then get them into that and just sort of like start this program of deprogramming them individually. But broadly speaking, how do we do this? I mean, as from a public policy standpoint, because I'm convinced that even if Elizabeth Warren had gotten up there and said, you know, I want all of the truly wealthy in this country, the 1%, the 5%, the 0.001%, just take a moment and think, were you ever lucky? I don't think they'd listen to her, and I don't think it would have that same impact, right?
Well, we have to do that experiment then. You know, Cornell sends me out to talk to alumni, and most of the groups I talk to are center left, at least NPR listeners. They're already sort of receptive to some of the ideas I throw out for them. But occasionally they'll send me to a bright red area, and if I've got 30 or 45 minutes to talk to a group, the receptivity to these notions is just as strong in those groups as in the more left-leaning groups. Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, they'll say, oh, I'd be happy to pay more in taxes to fund infrastructure rebuilding and opportunities for low-income people, but I'm afraid the government will waste the money.
Right.
And, you know, the whole waste, fraud, and abuse thing, you know, there are bridges to nowhere. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, I've seen government up close. I've been in the government. You know, the government people are pretty conscientious. You know, there's the waste, fraud, and abuse in government is a tiny fraction of not the fraud and abuse, which we also see in the private sector, but the waste in the private sector. You know, in the private sector, we waste money not because we're stupid, but because what I have to spend in order to stage a proper wedding for my daughter depends on what you and others are spending. And we all escalate mindlessly. We're not stupid. We just have no control over what we spend. And so we all spend up three times as much as we would need to have a proper wedding. And that's pure waste. So
and I would argue that money. I mean, I would argue that in every corporate environment, every large institution that I have been aware of or know of people involved in, it seems to me that job number one is waste. I mean, I honestly, like, I the way that money gets thown around in private industry is, it seems to me, is just shocking. And you know, part of it is just because everybody's, you know, going to get paid. But when people compare the waste in government, it seems to be in a vacuum, because I've never seen there not be waste at any institution or any corporation.
If people told me the government was more wasteful, I would, in the old days when U.S. Airways still exists, I would say, try changing planes in the F terminal in Philadelphia on U.S. Airways, and
right,
you'll get a good look at private waste and abuse.
Well, all right. So, and so lastly, just tell us about the progressive consumption tax, which you you talk about as a solution. Once we've convinced, once we're basically given permission to increase taxes by the those who have more control over our legislative process.
Okay, so if you want to get money to invest in useful things, where is the best place to get that money? The best place to get it is from spending streams that are now largely wasteful. Well, what are those? I think it's probably a fair assumption that if a family, a household unit, is spending $5 million a year now, the next dollar it spends is not on something that's urgent. It's probably something that's special in their eyes, and it would seem just as special to them if they and other families in their group would spend a little less on that thing, since special being a relative concept, that's just follows logically. So if we could somehow induce the people at the top of the income stream to spend a little less on mansions, to spend a little less on automobiles, jewelries, parties for special occasions, the standards that define special would adjust accordingly, and they'd be just as happy as before. And so that's free money, basically. It's just like somebody wrote you a check from outside the system. And the way we could do that, it's actually a fairly simple amendment to the tax code. Keep reporting income to the IRS the same as now, but simplify it. That would be a very useful step in any event. Then document how much you've saved during the year. People do that now for 401k plans and other savings instruments. The difference between those two numbers, your income minus your savings, that's how much you spent during the year. And that amount minus a big standard deduction, let's say $30,000 for a family of four, that's your taxable consumption. Tax rates start out very low. Your tax bill, if you were a middle-income family, would be as low or lower than it is under the income tax. But once you get up into the high-altitude regions of spending, the rate you pay on the next dollar that you spend can grow very, very steep indeed, much steeper than under the current income tax.
And so you're not talking about abolishing the income tax, just to be clear.
You could say scrap the income tax and replace it with a progressive consumption tax, which is what I am proposing. But it looks just like the income tax, except you deduct your savings.
Interesting.
And we know that the wealthy, when prices go up, the wealthy spend less. In New York, there are plenty of billionaires who could buy the whole building, but they live in 6,000 square feet because with high real estate prices in New York, it seems okay to live in 6,000 square feet. And we know that they would cut back if the cost of staging a $10 million wedding got to be $20 million, they'd tell the wedding planner to scale back.
And therefore, we would see less waste, I guess, wasteful spending down. It would trickle down in that respect.
Yeah, those dollars can be spent on things that would actually matter to people. You know, you could cover the cost of sending kids to preschool. You know, that makes a big difference. You could cover expansion of health insurance for people who don't have it already. You know, there are a lot of things you could do that we know would make a huge. You could pave the roads, which would benefit rich drivers as well as poor drivers.
Do we see examples of this tax system in any other countries around the world? And B, what if people start saving? This is the same dilemma we have in terms of income, in terms of tax as well, I guess. I mean, we're always going to be subject to different, incentives that people have.
Well, we do, to your first question, we do see this tax, not only in other countries, but we have it here with an important exception. There's a limit on how much of your savings you can deduct. So these 401k plans.
Right.
Have caps on them. And if you really want to slow this expenditure cascade that I talked about, you need to have a tax rate that gets the attention of people at the very top of the income ladder. And they already save way more than the caps on those plans. So you've really got to let people deduct as much as they choose to save, not those artificially low caps. But you know, people worry, well, if people saved more, that would send the economy into a tailspin since we depend on consumption as a source of spending so much. Yes, you wouldn't want to implement this when the economy is already in a downturn. But once we're at full employment, which we're almost back to, phase it in gradually. The effect of that would be to shift resources gradually away from consumption, particularly high-end consumption, toward investment. Those savings would be channeled into investment, both public and private. And the total amount of spending would not go down. In fact, the investment would increase productivity. So over the long run, income would grow. And sooner or later, your actual absolute consumption level would be higher than if we'd stayed on the current trajectory. Yeah, the fact that we're so inefficient in the way we use our resources. You know, most of the resources are going to the top of the income ladder. And those resources get spent on things that are the functional equivalent of arms races. they're self-canceling. It's like everybody's standing up to see better. Nobody sees any better than if everybody had remained comfortably seated. So we could just spend a whole lot smarter than we do and get a whole lot more bang for the resources we have. Nobody'd have to make painful sacrifices if we did this. It would be a big benefit for everyone. And that raises the question, why has it already happened? And I don't have a good answer to that.
Robert H. Frank, the book is Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm.
Thank you, Sam. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Bye-bye.